Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, Text 2. Just by way of explanation, I pulled what I believe is my abductor muscle. Yeah, the last time I straightened this up, the last time I gave class here and straightened this up, I don't know who was here, but it actually broke. So I'm a little reluctant to do that again. But unless I punch down like that. Okay. Yeah, just by way of explanation, I pulled what I believe is called the abductor muscle, and it makes it very, very hard for me to sit cross-legged. My concern is that I pulled it about a year ago. No, that's an exaggeration, but it's taking a long time to heal, hence sitting like this. Okay, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, The Forest of Enjoyment, and this is Text 2. I will just go to reading the translation. This is prose Sanskrit. So I'll just read the English translation. In the forest of material existence, the uncontrolled senses are like plunderers. The conditioned soul may earn some money for the advancement of Krishna consciousness, but unfortunately the uncontrolled senses plunder his money through sense gratification. The senses are plunderers because they make one spend his money unnecessarily for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, desiring, and willing. In this way, the conditioned soul is obliged to gratify his senses, and thus all his money is spent. This money is actually acquired for the execution of religious principles, but it is taken away by the plundering senses. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki. Purva janma rijita vijja, purva janma rijatam danam, agre davati davati. By following the principles of Varnashram Dharma, one attains a better position in the material world. One may be rich, learned, beautiful, or high-born. One who has all these assets should know that they are all meant for the advancement of Krishna consciousness. Unfortunately, when a person is misguided, he misuses his high position for sense gratification. Therefore, the uncontrolled senses are considered plunderers. The good position one attains by executing religious principles is wasted as the plundering senses take it away. By executing religious principles under the laws of Varnashram Dharma, one is placed in a comfortable position. One may very easily use his assets for the further advancement of Krishna consciousness. One should understand that the wealth and opportunity one gets in the material world should not be squandered in sense gratification. They are meant for the advancement of Krishna consciousness. This Krishna consciousness movement is therefore teaching people to control the mind and five knowledge acquiring senses by a definitive process. One should practice a little austerity and not spend money on anything other than the regulative life of devotional service. The senses demand that one see beautiful things, therefore money should be spent for decorating the deity in the temple. Similarly, the tongue has to taste good food, which should be bought and offered to the deity. The nose can be utilized in smelling flowers offered to the deity, even ones that are a few days old. And the hearing can be utilized by listening to the vibration of Hare Krishna mantra. In this way, the senses can be regulated and utilized to advance Krishna consciousness. Thus, a good position might not be spoiled by material sense gratification in the form of illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling. One spoils an opulent position in the material world by driving cars and motorbikes, particularly in the inner core area of Mayapur. One spoils an opulent position in the material world by driving cars, spending time in nightclubs, or tasting abominable food in restaurants. In these ways, the plundering senses take away all the assets that the conditioned soul has acquired with great difficulty. Translation again, in the forest of material existence, the uncontrolled senses are like plunderers. The conditioned soul may earn some money for the advancement of Krishna consciousness, but unfortunately the uncontrolled senses plunder his money through sense gratification. The senses are plunderers because they make one spend his money unnecessarily for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, desiring, and willing. In this way, the conditioned soul is obliged to gratify his senses, and thus all his money is spent. This money is actually acquired for the execution of religious principles, but it is taken away by the plundering senses. Om Majana Tamaranda Shanganjana Shalakaya Chakshu Umitamiena Tasmai Shri Gurvainamha Shri Titanya Manobishnam Stapitamiena Bhutale Svaya Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swabhadantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, the forest of enjoyment. I know it well. When I was first betrothed to be married, one of the instructions we got from our authority was to read Srimad Bhagavatam together with the future Mrs. So I chose the forest of enjoyment as a subject matter because I was still a good brahmachari. It's interesting that in this particular purport, Srila Prabhupada actually, because these chapters are these discussions are easy if we focus it on the non-devotees, but Srila Prabhupada is very much focusing it on devotees here. He's saying that money that you earn, he's talking about people who go through Varnashram system and they become elevated and good, well cultured and etc. and well situated, and then he's talking about those being seduced by the plunderers, the plundering senses, and instead of using that that good birth and that good those good qualities and also whatever wealth and resource that you have, using them in Krishna's service, you end up using them in Maya's service and for sense gratification. And there Prabhupada says, the Krishna consciousness movement is therefore teaching people to control the mind. Udaved atmanatmanam natmanam uvashadayet. That the mind is either our greatest friend or it's our worst enemy. And I think we can all relate to that. At least on the level of maybe not gross sense gratification. But the mind gets very, very agitated when people criticize us. If we hear that people are criticizing us, it actually can have a physical effect on our body, actually, when we hear that people are criticizing us. And we get very, very disturbed. And it's because of an uncontrolled mind. So it's a very high platform to achieve this controlling of the mind. But it starts with understanding that engaging in sense gratification is a waste of time, and it just causes suffering. And again, we all know that. I think everybody sitting here would be completely convinced of that. It's not that if I ask the question, someone's going to disagree with that particular point. We know if we use our senses in the service of Maya, it just causes suffering. And that's glorious, by the way, that's an absolutely glorious. We understand from Vedic culture that feeling guilty, maybe that's not the exact way that it's put, but the general mood is, or the general understanding is, that feeling guilty is a pious quality. That's a pious quality, to feel guilty. You know, modern Western philosophy would tell you that feeling guilty is because, you know, you've been subjugated in your earlier life or whatever by your parents or by your school teachers, and you should shed this burden of feeling guilty and live for the day and just do whatever you want. But actually, according to Krishna conscious philosophy, feeling guilty is a pious quality, and we should cherish it. We should actually cherish it. So when we sleep in, or we don't get all our rounds chanted in the day that they're supposed to be chanted, and we're feeling a little guilty about that. That's such a good thing, because it's an impetus for us to continue improving in our spiritual life. You know, speaking on this verse, you can speak, and listening to class yesterday by Janni Vasprabhu, and certainly, you know, ultimately nothing is possible without the mercy of Guru and Krishna, and we know that. At the same time, Srila Prabhupada said many times that, you know, and at one point he got particularly focused on this, and that was that he wanted, when he learned that his book distributors were not able to answer basic questions in his books, he was very strong on the point that, no, it's not just that you distribute these books, you have to read these books also and understand what's in them. Now, of course, understanding what's in them, oh, that is some task and some challenge. In this section of the Bhagavatam, I'm not sure the exact reference, I'm sure some of you know it, but Sukadeva Goswami informs Maharaj Parikit that Lord Brahma is bewildered by the points that are raised, that are being raised. Even Lord Brahma can't understand so much of what's been discussed in these particular sections of Bhagavatam. So understanding the subject matter is a lofty thing, and it's something that we shouldn't take glibly or think that it's something that just comes from you know, casual reading of Srila Prabhupada's books. Gyanam Teham Savigyanam is the start of the seventh chapter. I think it's chapter 7.2. And in that particular chapter, I'll read the English translation because I'm not sure of the exact translation. That's better, right? I'm closer to the phone. Okay. I have this thing about when you're close to a microphone that every now and again your face touches it. And feel it. Anyway. I'm thinking of all the other faces that have touched it. But I'm sure they're Vaishnava faces in the main, so I'm sure it's okay. Gyanam Teham Savigyanam is how Srila Prabhupada, Krishna starts that 7.2. And the English of that verse is, I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. There are many statements in Bhagavad Gita, that there's also 15.19, which I didn't mark, but I'll get quickly, 15.19, where Krishna says, let me get quickly, does anybody know 15.19's? Where Krishna says, Yo mam evam asam mudho. Whoever knows me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead without doubting is the knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in full devotional service. And then one of my favorite verses you've heard me quote here before, Etam vabhutam yogam cha mamayo veti tatvataha sovikalpena yogena yujate natrasamshaya. That those who are convinced, Krishna speaking again, those who are convinced of my opulence and mystic power and accept it in full, they will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So this idea of understanding Krishna and knowing Krishna and understanding this knowledge that Krishna is giving in Bhagavad Gita, etc. You know, you are then the knower of everything, and there's nothing further for you to know. And the logic is that once you know that, you have crossed the Rubicon, and there's no question of you coming back onto the other side, because you're in full realization of the whole nature of the spiritual and material world. However, the very next verse, as we know, a very famous verse that we all know very well, is, out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, and of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. Now this is really interesting, because oftentimes that verse, at least my understanding of hearing devotees speak on that verse, is that that's applicable to all of us. But I would put forward an argument, at least, that it's not really applicable to devotees who surrender to the process of Krishna consciousness. that they then don't qualify. Because oftentimes we will say that, well, how is it that there's going to be a golden age where essentially our understanding is that the vast majority of at least human beings, if not living entities, are going to be engaged in the process of Krishna consciousness. So I would put forward the argument that this verse, coming directly after the previous verse, is really indicating those people who are following the more the Sankhya process of understanding spiritual life and trying to understand everything in detail. Whereas those who have actually surrendered to the process of Krishna consciousness, they're in line to receive the mercy of Guru and Krishna, and they can bypass this particular ratio of out of many thousands among men, only one endeavors, etc., etc. At the same time, like I said earlier, that shouldn't be for us a kind of get-out card that then we don't try to fully understand the philosophy as is presented in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So here it's saying, I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. I don't know how many times I've read that verse without really bothering even, and this really just underlines my point about getting into understanding these things. I don't know how many times I actually read that verse before I decided to look up in the dictionary what phenomenal and numina or numinous means. You know, it was just, you just read it, and it's just one of these things you read like that. Now, of course, phenomenal, the English word, we often hear it being used, and it usually refers to, a devotee told me recently he was in Dubai, and he went to that place outside the Khaj Sharif, or what was the Khalid, what's it called? Burj Khalif, is that it? And there's a huge lake in front or around it, or whatever, the Burj Khalif. And particularly at night time, every half an hour, hour or something, they play music, usually quite dramatic music, classical music, or some famous sort of rock or pop songs. And they have this big light display accompanied by what's called dancing water. And the water just comes up and dances according to the music. Oftentimes when people see something like that, they'll use words like awesome, oh, it's awesome, or it's phenomenal. So phenomenal in English, we often use in that context, something that's pretty spectacular. We use it, oh, that's phenomenal. In the context of this verse, it means perceptible through the senses. Or something that we perceive through the senses and we identify as being our immediate experience. And of course the rest of the verse is saying, once you know both phenomenal and numinous, now of course the numinous or the numina is that which is behind the phenomena. And we understand that that's Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And as we know, as Bhagavatam explains, that Krishna is the, and of course Bhagavad Gita also, Ahamsavasya Prabhu, I am the creator of all spiritual and material worlds, like that. So Krishna is the noumena behind the phenomena. And therefore, if we have that understanding, and we're really fixed in that understanding, we have that realization, it's a strong realization, and we're completely fixed in it, then the out of many thousands among men verse won't apply to us, at least it won't apply to us in the same measure as it will apply to people who don't have that understanding of who the nomina behind the phenomena actually is. Of course, we shouldn't also jump to the easy conclusion that therefore none of this applies to me, because as Krishna says, those two verses I quoted and the one that I'm most familiar with, Etamva Bhutam Yogam Cha, Krishna's saying, if you actually understand that I'm the noumena behind the phenomena, and you understand who I actually am, what I'm actually able to do, my glories, my incredible opulences, my mystic power, if you actually understand that, you will engage in unalloyed, and Prabhupada, you know, although English wasn't his first language, Prabhupada used his words very, very carefully, with the assistance from his editors, actually, which is another discussion that we could have another time. But he used his words very, very carefully. And when he uses a word like unalloyed, he means it. And unalloyed is a really uncompromising word. You know, for all the people in the room who English is their first language, they will know. It's an uncompromising word. You can't get into a discussion about, well, yes, there's unalloyed and there's unalloyed. No, there's unalloyed. There's no unalloyed and unalloyed. There's just unalloyed. And that means that your service, you'll engage in unalloyed devotional service. It's uncontaminated. There's no contamination in it. It's pure. It's absolutely pure. And the second consideration is that it's ahoitakiya pratihata. It doesn't stop at any point in time. And that means 24/7. So that also means when we're sleeping, we're engaged in full devotional service. Now I know, and that's why one good reason to become a resident of Mayapur Dham, I understand that, you know, even when you're sleeping, you're engaged in devotional service, you're paying dandavats, etc., and you're engaged in full devotional service. But for those of us who are still unfortunate enough to be residing in the West, I don't think that we can make that same claim. So, you know, sometimes you have these mad dreams. Are they devotional service? But even our waking hours, are we engaged in unalloyed devotional service 24/7? Probably not. And therefore, or at least the vast majority of us are probably not. Therefore, we can't take this glibly and think the out of many thousands of men, that verse doesn't actually apply to us. So it's getting a balance between the two things. So I'd just like to speak a little bit, it's already 8:25, but I'll just speak a little bit on this dynamic of understanding these concepts. Because my understanding and a discussion with other devotees is that really the dispute between the materialists, and when I say the materialists, I particularly refer to scientists, the dispute between the scientists and the devotees in essence boils down not to phenomenal knowledge. Actually, phenomenal knowledge, knowledge that's derived through our sense perception, is something that the Bhagavatam doesn't actually disagree with the material scientists on. The disagreement really focuses on the noumena, what's behind the phenomena. And sometimes I think we make a big mistake when we're trying to present Krishna consciousness, particularly to the scientifically inclined. I think we make a mistake. You know, Sri Ramaraj gave a very nice talk here at the temple courtyard when we had one of those classes promoting the TOVP during the festival. I don't know how many of you were there for that class. And he said, this temple, for him, this temple represents the boot that Srila Prabhupada talked about when he said, I will use my boot to kick in the face of the scientists, like that. So we understand that, and that's very, very true. And of course, you do really get some obnoxious scientists actually as well, you know. But we know that story of Isaac Newton. How many people have heard that story of Isaac Newton and his creation of the replica of the material world? Yeah, maybe about 30%. So I won't bother repeating it. But still, that story would indicate that Isaac Newton was a theist, or at least he was an agnostic, and he didn't like his atheistic friends just automatically assuming that there was nothing behind the design and there was nothing behind the creation. So all experiences that physics and empirical philosophy present or deal with, they're actually, their disadvantages, they're limited by that phenomenal knowledge, that their perception through the immediate senses, they're actually limited by that. And they don't recognize the noumena behind the phenomena. But as devotees, when presenting these concepts, surely it's best to start from the platform of reaching agreement with people. Because once you reach agreement with people, you develop a certain relationship, and that relationship builds trust. That relationship builds respect, and people are more inclined to listen to you once you've developed that kind of relationship, as opposed to starting off in a very hostile and aggressive way. So here in this purport, in the translation, it's talking about the senses are plunderers because they make one spend money unnecessarily for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, desiring, and willing. So these. We have the senses that we understand, that the physical frame that the senses function through. So the sense of smell functions through the nose. But the nose in and of itself is a gross thing, And it's also not responsible for any wrongdoing like that. It's a little bit like, I suppose, to give an example, it's a little bit like if you're watching, a football match on the television, not that you would obviously be doing that, but I'm sure you've done it at some time in your existence. And when I say football, I mean real football, not that funny stuff that they do in North America. But football, or whatever you watch on a television, whatever it might be, that you're perceiving that that's what's happening. But if you... Now, this is... for me also, these concepts are quite tricky. But you're looking at that, and your perception is that there's a football match taking place. But really, again, there's a distinction between what you're perceiving and what's really happening. Because it's true, like the nose is the gross thing. It doesn't actually do anything. You're seeing that through the medium of a television like that. That's what you're seeing. That you're not actually seeing the real thing as it's actually happening like that. So these subtle distinctions about the physical framework that the senses function through, and then the subtle thing of the actual senses operating themselves. And again, it's very good for us to understand these things because it helps us, it can actually help us to control control the senses when we know what's actually happening and the mechanics and how it all kind of works. It's just the more information we have and the more knowledge we have, the easier it is for us to deal. Otherwise, it's very easy to become bewildered and think that it's just overpowering and it's overwhelming and the senses are just impossible to control like that. We also tend to equate experiencing something, so the acquiring of phenomenal knowledge, we also tend to equate that with real knowledge, that's it's not just experiencing, but now I'm knowing something. So we look at something on the television and we think, oh, whatever was presented, now we know that has actually happened and that's an actual reality, as opposed to something that we're just acquiring through the knowledge acquiring senses like that. A little bit like, and actually I'll read this because I think it's really, really relevant to this subject. And it just so happens that it's the very, very first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam that in one sense you all know very, very well, but in another sense it's always good to reacquaint ourselves with these things. So I was going to say another example is, and how we always have to be careful. Like, let me say, for instance, as an example, if you look out that window now and you see all sorts of activities taking place, you see the trees, you see the water, you see people walking like that, you assume that is a reality. But actually, if you walk out of this room now, and I get some devotees who are very expert at this thing to set up a reflective, see-through reflective window that can project 3D images and project the image that's through the window, but it's actually projected on the see-through screen, so therefore you can't see the screen because it's see-through, and you come back in to this room, and you look out that window again, and you see the exact same scene, you will assume that it's the same scene that you looked at 10, 15, 20 minutes ago, but actually it's not. It's the same scene being reflected on a 3D screen. So in that sense, you know, we can be easily tricked about what we're perceiving through the phenomenal senses. A little bit more, one that may be a little easier to relate to, will be, I've never experienced this myself, but a mirage in the desert. Your body and your senses are dictating to you that you want to drink water. You're really, really, really thirsty. I mean, this phenomena of how the mind can play tricks with us is a well-known science, actually. It's not just being exposed or proposed through the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a well-known science. But if you're in a desert and you're really, 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 really thirsty, what happens? You see an oasis. And the oasis is a kilometer away, or however far it is away, and you walk towards it, and you see that oasis, and that oasis has nice trees, and it's got running water, and you are just feeling in ecstasy. But as you approach, literally as you get to it, it just vanishes and disappears like that. So again, it's the phenomenal senses seeing something, but actually is what we see. Can we always have faith that what our phenomenal senses perceive, can we have faith that it's actually reality? And when you translate that to the whole creation of the material world and how we interact with the material world, it actually becomes a very interesting discussion. But I'm going to read now the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. O my Lord Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, sustenance and destruction of the manifested universe. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. Now this is the key sentence that I wanted to read. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion, as one is bewildered by the illusory representations of water seen in fire or land seen on water. So water seen in fire, you can equate to being the mirage in the desert. Only because of him do the material universes temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature appear factual, although they are unreal. So again, they're appearing factual to us, but actually they're unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, which is forever free from the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. And again, that goes back to the point that I said at the beginning, that, you know, meditating upon Krishna and being convinced of who Krishna is and everything about Krishna, we can easily cross beyond the multitude, the unlimited complexities of the material world and the unlimited illusions that the material world can present to us as being real. Now, going back to the point about the scientists, because that's what I wanted to focus on, because essentially it's a preaching point. How we can influence people who have great influence in the material world. When Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking speak, an awful lot of people listen. And governments listen and all of that kind of stuff. A lot of influential people listen when these people speak. If we can actually influence these people to understand that there is no discrepancy between, essentially no discrepancy between their analysis of the material world and the Bhagavatam analysis of the material world, you know, we have a really good opportunity to start making progress with these people and bring these people in to understanding a little more. And on that point, this is something that's been more and more accepted in the philosophical and scientific world. They've even given it a name, and the name that they've given it is critically irrational. Critically irrational. They come up with fantastic, we know that, they're brilliant. You know, they are absolutely brilliant at coming up with clever phrases for things. As we've discussed, I'm sure, before, when the economic crisis broke 5-6 years ago, whenever it was, and they couldn't find a solution to it because there wasn't enough money, and all capitalistic philosophy up to that point was that to avoid inflationary tendencies, you never ever print money. Printing money for the sake of printing money creates inflation and destroys the economy, because as Prabhupada said in those wonderful conversations, I think in 1972, about inflation, when Prabhupada was asked what is inflation or why does it exist, and Prabhupada said, because they've broken the connection with gold, they've broken the value of the money they produce or print to gold, and therefore they just print money. It's not backed up by the wealth in terms of real wealth, gold and assets, that they have in their vaults, and therefore you create inflation. So now they had this crisis because they needed to print money. And up to that point, for the last 40, 50 years, capitalistic philosophy was you cannot just print money. So they didn't want to admit to printing money. So they come up with this term called, what was it called? I've forgotten. Quantitative easing. And like, it's again, it's like the material world and the phenomenal experiences. You hear the term, like I read in Bhagavad Gita many times, this verse, before I really checked out what does phenomenal and numinous mean. So you just hear this term, most people hear it, and it just sort of flies over their head. Ah, quantitative easing, quantitative, and no one has a clue what it means. And then when you actually analyze it, what's quantitative easing? It just means they're printing money like that. So they've come up with this thing called... It's a question from Mayapur TV that has absolutely no bearing on one single thing that I said in the class. I mean, just absolutely. So it's from Dasu Anudas, Hare Krishna Das Anudas, wherever the camera is. But, yeah. Anyways, what was I saying? Quantitative easing. Critically irrational. This is the phrase that they've come up with. And what that means when you analyze it is realization. Many in the scientific world now accept that you cannot, basically what they're saying is, we cannot figure everything out by the ascending process. That's essentially what they're saying, a big school of thought in the scientific world. And therefore, we have to also include this thing called critically irrational. And critically irrational essentially means realization, which of course is one step away from accepting the descending process. That's actually what it is. It's just one step away from them accepting the descending process. So that was really the point I'd like to make, because this section of Bhagavatam, the forest of enjoyment, the whole thing, now we get into the hellish planets and we all these allegorical stories, and then people start quoting from Jivadharma, do the hellish planets actually exist, or are they just an allegorical kind of framework for us to understand these things, etc., etc. So really, we can only ever, even Prabhupada actually, when he was writing the fifth canto and talking, ironically enough, talking about the temple of the Vedic planetarium, and he wanted all the presentations in the temple of the Vedic planetarium, he wanted those to show the alternative view of the cosmic manifestation and the creation of the material and spiritual universes. Devotees were asking him different questions, and at one point Prabhupada said, I've given you the basic framework. I've translated these verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. Now you go and figure it out. It's complicated. It's not straightforward and easy and simple. It's complicated. Ultimately, we can only understand these things if we are pure and that we have the mercy of Guru and Krishna to understand. But part of that developing that purity and part of that process of being able to understand is us wanting to understand, and us wanting to actually surrender to study these things as best we can, and using our intelligence. Prabhupada would say that also in the fifth chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada lists all these different aspects of life. He lists poetry, he lists economics, he lists so many, I can't remember them now, but then he also lists physics and science and chemistry. He lists those. And he says, when these are properly used in the service of Krishna, they're not Maya. There's nothing wrong with any of these things. They just have to be used in the proper service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But of course, when they are used in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then they become perfect like that. Okay, I think I'll stop there and ask, whoa. I don't take questions from intelligent devotees. It's too challenging for me. But this devotee here with the ring, he was absolutely first. What's your name, Prabhupada? I don't think I know your name.
Prabhupada said, when we take through this process, you go and get a first class ticket to the train. Some of you have probably heard this, I don't know. We have the first class ticket, so we're guaranteed passage on the train. But if we're not on the track when that train leaves, the ticket is useless. So these 2 points kind of settled my mind down that we still have hope, we have a chance. I always, when you started to discuss that, it really triggered this anxiety that I felt as a new devotee. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. And in essence, we already discussed it, but that in one sense, it doesn't apply to us because we are surrendering to the process, to Guru and Krishna. But we can also take that, as you say, oh, I've got my ticket, now everyone's... No, we have to also make sure that we're at the right place at the right time to avail of the benefits of that ticket. So, yeah, thank you very much. While you were speaking, there's one other thing I wanted to make, a point I wanted to make, actually. And that was that these verses in the seventh, at the beginning of the seventh chapter, when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, the first verse I ever learned, and I'm sure just as one of these you know, ad hoc statistical surveys, how many of you were the same as me? The first verse that I ever learned from Bhagavad Gita was Dehino Samumiyata Dehe. How many was that the first verse that you ever learned when you joined the Hare Krishna movement? Really? Only three? Oh no, okay. Yeah. So, you know, and for many years, Even the title of that chapter, Contents of the Gita Summarized, you know, I would just automatically... I mean, in one sense, we don't make distinctions anyway, but there was an automatic kind of tendency to conclude that that chapter of Bhagavad Gita was really, for me at least as a beginner, was the most important chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, Contents of the Gita Summarized and understanding the difference between matter and spirit, soul and the body. But in the eighth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the purport to the very last verse, actually, which is verse 28, so 8:28, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, I'm sure some of you are familiar with this, chapters 7 through 12 are the essence of Bhagavad Gita. The first six chapters and the last six chapters are like the coverings for the middle six chapters, which are especially protected by the Lord. If one is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita, especially these middle six chapters, then his life at once becomes glorified beyond all penances, sacrifices, charities, speculations, etc. For one can achieve all the results of these activities simply by Krishna consciousness. So the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is the middle six chapters, and the first of the middle six chapters is the seventh chapter. So you can argue that the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, certainly the beginning of the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, is chapter 7. And therefore the second verse in chapter 7 is Ganam Teham Sabhijnanam, that when we know all that what is phenomenal and what is numinous, we are the knower of everything. And there is nothing further that remains for us to know. So it's just interesting that that's the first chapter of the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Vrajendra Nandana Guru.
Thank you, Prabhu, for sharing your insights and understandings. I am dull-headed, so if I can ask, when you were saying essentially we don't have a disagreement with the Bhagavatam and the material sciences, where was that in relationship that, okay, they say they can't understand everything, the Bhagavatam says we have imperfect senses, and as such you aren't going to acquire perfect knowledge, is that what you're saying?
Actually, I should have gone on because, you know, sometimes, you know, you have thoughts in your head to speak and just when you speak, you stray and this and that. But I should have gone on in the seventh chapter. What I essentially was meaning, although that's also true, what you've said is also very true. But what I was particularly referring to is the next verse in the seventh chapter, which is 7:4, which again, a verse that we're all very familiar with, Bhumir Apo Nalo Vayu. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego, all these together constitute my separated material energies. And then, of course, you know, the next verse is saying, besides these, Amadi Aram Darjuna, there is another superior energy of mine. So, from the material scientific point of view, at least the first five of those eight separated energies, at least the first five, you can make an argument. I think then we get into some subtleties between different scientific views in terms of, like I mentioned earlier, someone like Newton as opposed to somebody like, you know, Dawkins. I think he's he's an unalloyed atheist. He's a pure atheist. So you get into distinctions between different scientific views. But I think you'll find that virtually all scientific views will agree with those first five elements. All material interaction and everything that's created in the material world and everything that happens in the material world is as a result of those elements interacting. Where they disagree is, again, the noumena, where they come from. You know, like that. So that's more what I was referring to. That if we stick on the earth, water, fire, air, ether platform with scientists and the Bhagavatam analysis of those, you know, I think you'll find that with the vast majority of scientific personalities, that we'll be on a common platform. So that's specifically what I was referring to. And then when you build up a relationship on that common platform, when you actually build a relationship with them, it's just much more likely that they're going to be inclined to listen to your views on what's behind. Because they accept that. That was my point about critical... critical irrationality. That was my point about that. They haven't agreed on what that is and what's all involved in that, but they've agreed that studying earth, water, fire, air, ether is not enough. There is something more than that. That the vast majority of them have accepted. So let's build a relationship with them on what we agree on without virtually any dispute. And then once you've developed that relationship, then introduce to them the possibility that this might be what critical irrationality is. So that was the basic point that I was making. Vasudev Prabhu. And then Prabhu.
Well,
Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you very much. I noticed that when I adopt a confrontational approach in outreach, trying to reach out, preaching, that it is counterproductive. It puts people, whether they are scientists or sympathizers of the scientists, supporters of the scientists, it's a common reaction. And like they say, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And we know that in the ranks of religion, there are plenty of teachers, bogus gurus. There's a lot of room for atheists and scientists to turn the finger back at us and keep the discussion on a very low level. If we give them the credit that they are at least sincerely trying and searching, spending decades and more into researching the measurements of the universe, that at least their perception, whether it is, you know, relative, maybe superseded by a higher perception which we are promoting, which the Bhagavatam is promoting, that we might have better success in the promotion of our Vedic planetarium, for example. If we simply want to show that this is true and your version of, you know, the moon being a satellite of the earth, for example, that is complete fabrication, it has no reality whatsoever, not even in a multi-dimensional universe, then how are we proposing to have any success along those lines? I suggest that we give at least the scientists the credit that their measurements has some validity, but that it is superseded by a higher reality which we are presenting. Could you please comment on that?
Yes, and again, the point about phenomena, that that's, phenomena means we're acquiring information through and we're getting our perception through the senses. So, you know, it's a very complex subject matter, you know, in terms of distances and all of that kind of stuff. And really, when you have, because a lot of people know nothing about science, actually, when it comes down to it. But in our society, scientists have a real authority. They just have an authority. It's just that we can't change that. They have an authority. So for the average person, they just accept what the scientists say. So there is no point in just challenging those things, but as you say, acknowledge, but then discuss in the broader context, in a scientific context, that, you know, science is the nature of exploring and understanding things. So in the context of the definition of science, we cannot rule out these possibilities, and then we can discuss about our possibilities. But yeah, it really doesn't make sense to, basically speaking, what's the other example we give about, you choose the battles that you can win. There's no point going into a battle that you're losing from the start. There's no point wasting energy. You know, choose battles that you can win and build momentum like that. But when you were speaking, two things that came to mind about that very point. The first one is when I was a very young devotee, and I think it was my first Sunday feast talk I ever gave. I think it was my very first Sunday feast talk. So, you know, it's a big occasion for the individual person on the platform of False Ego, at least. You know, it was my first Sunday feast lecture. It was in a place, it's in a place called Belfast. And I was giving that. The preceding days, or preceding week or whatever, I was reading the Bhagavatam section that deals with childbirth. Okay, and for those of you who know that section of Bhagavatam, Prabhupada, both through the translations and the purports, there's a really strong focus on the actual moment of childbirth when the baby comes out through the narrow canal, and even describes how, and of course for me that was great, I understood better, let's say. You know, when babies are first born, you see pictures of them, oftentimes like their heads are about like that long, you know, and that narrow, you know, like that. That's why it's happening, you know, because they're being forced out. The skull isn't formed as such, it's still soft. And they're being forced out through that narrow canal. So you get this elongated kind of head, you know, looks like a margin or something. So that's the section of the Bhagavatam I'm reading. And it's explained how, because of that traumatic experience, while in the womb, the baby is in the prayer position. And it's asking, you know, for mercy and guidance, you know, and it's apologizing for its sinful activity that's brought it to this situation. It's looking for shelter, etc., etc. But then that traumatic experience of being forced out through the canal, whatever that canal's called, I forget the technical name, it loses its memory. And then it just becomes bewildered. And all of the memory it had in the womb of wanting, you know, to be Krishna conscious, etc., it loses all that. So when my Sunday feast talk came, because that's in your mind, you've been reading that whole section of Bhagavatam, I was focusing on this, you know, and I was making this point really strongly and dramatically in the class, you know, in the Sunday feast talk. And I'm thinking it's a great point, the whole thing. And then it came to the end, I asked, any questions? And this person, you know, in the front row just put their hand up in a very mild manner, nice manner, put their hand up and said, yeah, I'm just wondering then, would those babies who have a cesarean section, would they still remember Krishna? And I thought, and the mind's whirring at 100 miles an hour, you know. How am I going to answer this? So you waffle a little bit, you know. And then I just refer to, well, actually, yes, but then when they come out, you get all the aunties and the uncles going, coochie-goo, coochie-goo, you look just like your granddad, or you just look like your granny, and do-do-do-do-do, and you're beautiful, and you're-do-do-do-do. And gradually, they lose their memory of Krishna, as opposed to instantaneously through that process. But just in answer to your point, we have to be very careful the subjects that we talk on, you know, that we have a full picture of them and a full understanding of them. Otherwise, we can be caught out quite easily. And one other point I'll just quickly make is that in the book is the topmost yoga system, and I have the quote here. Prabhupada says, and I'm reading verbatim, Prabhupada says in that book, he says, knowledge begins not from Krishna, but from things we are accustomed to see every day. So knowledge begins not from Krishna, but things that we're accustomed to see every day. So we really need to marry these two ends of a discussion. One is acquiring knowledge in the correct way and understanding things as they are, and the other is taking shelter of Guru and Krishna to be inspired from within and to be pure enough to actually advance in Krishna consciousness and overcome all of those things. I see two more hands, and then I think we have to stop because I'll get in trouble. One hand is this gentleman here in the red kurta, and then there's Santadanya Prabhu at the back. whoever has the microphone closest, maybe they can take. Oh, you have the microphone. Very good.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, being me coming from scientific fraternity, I was a bit offended when Shivaram Maharaj said that this is going to the boat.
You were what?
I was offended.
Offended? Ooh, okay. Shivaram Maharaj, if you're watching, somebody was offended.
So, I like to put some point, there are a lot of people from scientific fraternity who have a strong belief in Krishna. In fact, one of our famous Indian mathematicians, Ramanujan, he was a Vaishnava. So this point should not be ignored. A lot of people who believe in religion, Krishna, they are in part scientific fraternity. And as the society we are evolving, and ISKCON is evolving at a global organization, we don't feel that we should be more euphemistic when we speak with the scientific world. This is my point of contention.
Thank you, Prabhu. My understanding as that Mataji, what was her name, get class the other day?
Kamalini.
When Kamalini, her nice class she gave the other day, she referred to Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj and him creating that fair of 100 stalls or exhibits or more, whatever it was. I think only one was a Krishna conscious one or two selling books. All the others were, some were displaying, the latest agricultural machinery, some were displaying this, that, and the other, whatever it was. And all of it, all it was, and Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is known as the Nrsingha Guru, but it was, to use Prabhupada's phrase, building a better mousetrap. Prabhupada used that phrase here in Mayapur specifically, that we should build a better mousetrap. So our whole idea is, whether they're born again Christians, whether they're atheists, whether they're scientists, whether they're this, whether they're that. The whole mission that we have as followers of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada is to make it as easy as possible for them to come to Krishna consciousness. And offending people or pushing people away doesn't make it easy for them to come to Krishna consciousness. So we should try to find a common platform. Last question. That man doesn't need a microphone.
What Vasudev said, I would just like to say, on the other hand, often Prabhupada, of course, is known not to pull any punches. And, like the moon being closer than the sun.
The moon
being closer
than the sun. And in
fact, I don't know if it was 68 or 69, but one very prominent devotee at the time,
moon being farther than the sun. Excuse me. One very prominent devotee at the time, he was
like the Mahakrishna or Aranda at
that time. Rama. He actually, for all intents and purposes, left the movement.
But Prabhupada insisted, So I guess there's time for both. We can't ultimately be diplomatic. Once when Kirtananda at that time,
I was just discussing with Shruti Kirti the other day. Prabhupada said something, I don't even remember what it was, but it was very, one of those type of things, very direct. And Kirtananda addressed the public or the press at that time saying what Prabhupada actually meant was this, this, this. And then Prabhupada interrupted and said, no, I didn't mean that, I meant this, and emphasized the most undiplomatic aspect of it. So of course, sometimes we have to marry the both, but it doesn't mean that we suppress, certain aspects of truth.
Absolutely, and I think as Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj gave a story the other day, and then at the end of it, he said, when Prabhupada did that really heavy preaching, I think it was to the Ramakrishna Mission people or whatever it was, Prabhupada says, but you cannot preach like that. So we have to have the adhikar to be able to, there's nothing more unpalatable. How many times, I'll give you an example, okay? I'll give you an example. And there's nothing more unpalatable than this, in my humble opinion, in terms of you want to present Krishna consciousness nicely, and then you hear something like this, and you just feel, oh my God, what a disservice to Srila Prabhupada. This again is years ago, at a Sunday feast again, and it's when the Sunday feast is over, and we're taking prasadam, and in those days at least, I think things have changed a little in ISKCON, but in those days at least, different devotees would sort of take a guest, you know, or a couple of guests, and sit with them and take prasadam with them. And the idea would be they follow on from the lecture and try to encourage them more in Krishna consciousness. But oftentimes, because we were young devotees, oftentimes it was just a false ego thing. You just wanted to smash the people, you know, and be more intelligent than them, you know. Anyway, I was sitting down one time taking my prasadam, and I was, you know, multitasking. I know men can't multitask, but, you know, I must have been a lady in my last body, or I'm preparing to be a lady in my next. But, you know, I think I have a little bit of an ability to multitask. So I'm having a conversation with the person I'm sitting with, but I'm listening to the conversation that another devotee is having with some people. And the person says to this devotee, they spoke in the class about the difference between the body and the soul. How do we detach ourselves? Because for me, it's very difficult. My mother just died, you know, and I assumed it was very recent, like within the last, you know, whatever. And the devotee jumps in and said, Prabhu, she's not your mother. It's just stool, and there's no point crying over spilt milk. And I thought, you know, this is a person who doesn't know anything about Krishna consciousness, you know? It's like the mother is the... Actually, I resonated with it, actually, because my mother died when I was quite young, and it still remains the most traumatic experience that I have had in this material world. I was 12 when my mother died, and it's just... By far, there's nothing in my life so far, I presume leaving my body, you know, that's going to be a close second probably, but depending on my consciousness, but nothing since then or before then compares with that experience. It's just way out there. So here's a person coming, my mother's just died, you know, she's not your mother, the body's just stool, and there's no point crying over spilt milk. It's like, did that person come back to the next Sunday feast? Maybe they did, I don't know, whatever. I'll finish on a final little thing. One of Krishna's names is Urukram, okay? Urukram, okay? Do we know what Urukram means? Ones whose actions are beyond the imagination. Not just beyond perception or beyond reality, but are actually beyond the imagination of the living entity. So this whole subject of phenomenal and noumenon, and, you know, understanding what is it that we see through the senses, how real is it, you know, how trusting can we be of it, etc., etc. It's actually a fantastic subject matter. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.